is Dan Brown here today with another A Lens a Day Conversations about Information Architecture. And today I'm super excited that I get to talk to the peerless Adam Bielanski. Adam, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Adam, I'm talking to folks about IA process. I know this is something that is near and dear to your heart as well. What would you say is your favorite technique for drawing people into the process? And the reason why I ask that is because process, IA itself is abstract. And I think sometimes the process for doing IA can be a little bit of a black box, right? It's just, it seems like magic. People don't really understand how it works, what we do, but we do need to draw folks in. So what are some of the ways that you have found to successfully draw people into that process?
Okay. Well, if you got your bingo cards out, I'm going to get this one out of the way right now.
Nice.
First, I am going to try to get some idea of the people that I'm either working with or presenting to, because different things push different buttons for different people. If I'm working with somebody who's sort of very rooted in the business school approach to things, then I'm going to choose certain techniques based on that. If I'm dealing with somebody who maybe has a little bit more of a creative bent and a little bit better understanding of the qualitative, then I'll do some other things. So it's a question of understanding which language you need to speak. Something that Richard Saul Wurman said in Phoenix some years ago, that when he wasn't just being a crank, was when he said that an information architect's job is to create understanding. And I've sort of attached that to pretty much everything I've done since. And so creating understanding means understanding how people understand things. So in terms of sort of universal approach, I am particularly partial to starting with something that is lo-fi, something that is organic, meaning that it's about conversation. It's about all the cues you pick up when you're talking with people. And in this case, I'm talking about business stakeholders first, because they're your first users. So, excuse me. And then the rest of your team, of course, because you're collecting information and holding up to make sure everybody else sees that you understand it. By doing the sort of lo-fi organic approach, people feel a little more invested and they feel a little bit more like they contributed. Now, in the days before, that meant getting everybody together in the same place physically, sitting in a room with a whole bunch of whiteboards and flip charts, and having that room prepared. So this is really talking probably more about discovery, to have a number of different exercises that you've chosen for different reasons based on who's going to be in the room. But the reason that I like lo-fi is because it is so outside what people are used to in a business setting, which is oftentimes a PowerPoint with a lot of charts and metrics and things that they want to aim for, when the whole reason I'm there is to help create a better experience. So I need to know those things, certainly. And those are valuable, but at some point I need to be able to change the conversation to being about the experience and what we're going to do. And so the thing, I feel like lo-fi is probably the best way to get people to feel an experience and thereby feeling a little more invested in what's going on. So when you're having a conversation, and even if you just stand up and take your notes on the whiteboard, you're now taking everybody's notes. You can't write as fast as everybody, so you're going to have to summarize, which means you're getting consensus. And it also makes your notes the notes. So it could be that, it could be a mind map, you know, any number of other things that helps you collect and contextualize thoughts. A mind map, of course, is very loose and nonlinear. There are advantages to that. Sometimes you need to drop things into a little bit more of a sequence. Yeah, there's no one way. Now, with the beginning of the pandemic, the first week after we were told everybody had to stay home, I was told I needed to run a discovery session for a very large client. And it had to be entirely virtual, which of course was the antithesis of everything that I have had invested myself in for, you know, the previous 10 years or so. How the hell was I going to do this? So I won't go into the long story. It's actually out in places where you can read it. So if you're going to Medium or something like that, and I've also spoken about it. The long and the short of it is that while there's a lot about those tools that throws the benefits of working in public and working hands-on with people completely out the window, there are other benefits to be drawn. One is the fact that even though it doesn't seem like it, we're right up against the edge of something that is either asynchronous or synchronous, which means everybody can't talk at once. And so it's a little easier to funnel information in and to sequence things. The other thing is that you really need to go into it, or any discovery session, asking yourself, actually not looking at all the things you now can't do, but look at what you can do. Look at what the platform lets you do. And so in setting this up, I found that there's certainly a lot, there's some advantage about having everybody being able to do things simultaneously, whether it's sticky notes. If I've got one, I'm using these days as sort of a combination of a journey map, empathy map, and emotional chart. And I'm kind of proud of it, actually. And really only, I'm only responsible for the last part. Some other really smart people, you know, gave me the first bits and I just extended on that. But the fact that you can put people in separate Zoom or in separate rooms and they can all still work on the same diagram has its advantages. I remember seeing demos for collaborative software. The sizzle reel always had some shot of 35 different icons roaming around a screen. And that was my worst nightmare. The last thing I wanted was, you know, I'm trying to get things to stand still. And so that was, again, the opposite of what I thought I needed to accomplish. But even then, I also was able to pull in things, you know, some tried and true things that you would think wouldn't be possible. Since I've been doing a sketching workshop, I have a little document camera. I have a stack of little whiteboards. And so we were able to go into sessions such as, you know, sort of the information dump you'll get from a client or other conversations, and map them in whiteboard on my little whiteboard, take a picture of it, stick it up on the mirror board, and there it was added to, you know, the compendium of things that we were doing. So, and that was valuable because, again, it still lent sort of a handmade feel to it. Right. An advantage of being handmade is that people also tend to feel like that's bespoke for them.
Right.
Wow, they're doing this for me. They didn't just, you know, dust off something out of the box and change the names. So that's the first thing. The second thing is essentially probing for the level of fidelity I need to bring to the work itself. I have had clients who can look at a whiteboard sketch and that's everything they need to see, and we're ready to put it in the hands of designers and developers. Or designers at least, but we're ready to get input from development just to make sure there's nothing there that horrifies them. But I have clients who also have looked at some pretty hi-fi wireframes, but they're still all in grayscale and they just can't get it. So I have to dress it up a little bit and swearing on everything that is holy to me, to the designers, that I am not designing the screen, this is still a wireframe. If you can't wad it up and throw it away, it is not a wireframe. So it takes a little balance, but most of the designers that I work with these days are they know that. They know that I'm not handcuffing them. I'm just trying to get a level of understanding for a client so we can get on with the work. So those are probably the two empirical things. And regardless of where the client sort of sits in their level of understanding or what's important to them or how they understand things, one way or another, those two things are going to come into play.
Right. You know, I think of doing lo-fi work as trying to take something that is abstract, and because it's abstract, scary, and make it less scary, right? It's sort of like seeing illustrations in a children's book, in a sense, where even the things that are supposed to be scary aren't so, so scary, because that's not sort of a high fidelity, you know, Wes Craven style movie making.
Sure, we fear the unknown.
Right.
But so you're making it just a little more known.
But there's something else that you said that made me, that perked me up in so far as lo-fi also creates not just a sense of ownership in the stakeholders, but and a sense of sort of making it accessible, but personal as well. And that really spoke to me. Like, I'm not just pulling out the same old, you know, 10 screens that I've designed. I'm drawing something specifically in this moment for you. And I feel like, you know, whatever that relationship is to information architecture, that is something that's important from a client management perspective. How does that resonate with you? And do you feel like there is something about IA in that as well?
Absolutely. So I guess probably the other biggest prevailing undercurrent that you need to try to develop is trust. So in order to do pretty much anything down the line with any level of efficiency, you've got to build a level of trust. Otherwise, you're going to have to hold every single thing up for people to look at and approve before you can go on. And every time you do that, you're opening it up to arbitrary change, which in itself can be a nightmare. Because if you got somebody who's an I know it when I'll see it person, then that's just going to be hell on earth. So if you, by doing this, you're essentially extending yourself and I suppose you could say you're making yourself vulnerable, because you're willing to get up there and you're willing to put the stuff up on the wall and you're willing to be wrong. And you're also showing that this isn't all just genius shit coming out of your head. This is all informed by the people in the room, the subject matter experts who know they're the subject matter experts and know you're not. So, you're essentially forging ties. And if you can build that level of trust in the early stages, then that's going to affect everything else that happens downstream.
Yeah. That sort of reminds me a little bit anyway of the lens that we picked. Why don't you tell us what lens did we pick and what about it resonated with you?
Yeah. So, I selected importance, which is a lens under how to include. And the reason that I liked it, or the reason that I went for it, is it was less about the nuts and the bolts and the things we do when we get in the tall grass, about specific things we do with, you know, at an interaction level, or even if we're working out an information architecture, trying to play with the different connections between information in different contexts. This backs up a little bit more to kind of where I've probably been dwelling more for about the last 10, 12 years, is in things that can be considered a little more agnostic. Sure. As opposed to a specific, or I should say a unique property of information architecture. So things like helping people, showing people that they can write the alphabet, they can sketch. Okay. Showing people that even if you don't get up at a podium and speak, in front of 500 people, you're still probably going to have to stand at one end of a big long table full of a room of A-type personalities. And so what are tricks and things to know and understand going into that? So this seemed to be out in the broader space, because I think all the bullet points here really have different answers depending on the context you give them.
Right. So the thrust of this lens is for you to sort of, as you're designing something, maybe a structure, maybe a page layout, even as you were saying before, sort of capturing certain aspects of a conversation that's going on, you need to recognize that some of these aspects are important to some certain people in the room. Because it serves a specific need, or without putting too fine a point on it, right, it scratches a certain itch, like it's something that someone needs to see there, and therefore it is important to them. Can you think of a time when that sort of came up in your own work?
Oh, sure. And I think this is true for just about anybody who is working in visual information. If you can learn early on that somebody has a particular bee in their bonnet for a particular thing, they may offer it up as an example, but a little more context will show you that, yeah, they want to see this. Not an interpretation, but they want to see the thing they've asked for. And so it's not true all the time, but more often than not, there is a circumstance where whatever other ideas you have and whatever other direction you think this is going to go, you don't get to do that until you scratch that itch first. You have to get it in front of them. They have to see it. They have to be satisfied that you heard them and that you have made an attempt in earnest at helping them realize that, even in the very early stages. And then by doing that, it's now up for discussion. And by having set that down, you can now talk about alternatives.
Right.
If you don't do that, then all they're going to be doing is waiting to hear the thing they're waiting to hear, and they won't hear anything else.
Right. I was working on, this was years and years ago, I was working on an intranet. And one of the sort of fallback techniques that I use when I'm designing, say, a set of categories, is I'll put two words together, you know, like just to come up with a terrible example, like human resources and benefits, right? Like to show,
are these direct connections?
Right. Well, to show that a category encompasses a broad umbrella of things, right? So the category name will have something and something in there. And this is going to become a very mundane example, but the stakeholder that I was working with did not like the ampersand symbol to connect those two things together. And it was important to this person that I spell out the word "and." Mm-hmm. I don't know why it was so important to them, but it was. And we could not have a conversation about the structure unless there were no ampersands in it. And it was confusing. And I mean, we're talking probably 10 years ago now. So it's traumatized me enough that I remember it. And to this day, I replace all my ampersands with "ands," because I don't want to create create a distraction, essentially. Yeah. So
this is actually another topic, but whether you're preparing for some kind of a usability testing or something like that, that's probably one of the most important things, is figuring out how to eliminate distractions. And one of the ways you can do that is by figuring out what everybody's third rail is. And people drag all kinds of neuroses into these things. So it won't necessarily make sense, but if you can uncover it, it's going to be a good thing for you and everybody, and it keeps everybody's eye on the ball. You're
I'm muted. Yep. The other thing I think we struggle with in terms of importance is when we're trying to balance two things that seem like they are in conflict with each other, right? This is important to that person and this is important to that person. How do we reconcile those two things? And I feel like I get asked this question a lot, like, how do you manage that? And the truth is, for me anyway, there's no silver bullet, right? There's just no easy way to do that. That's part of the work. And I've not really sort of taken the time to sit down and think about how do I tease that out? But I'm going to put you on the spot because I get to. So, I mean, what is at least one way that's worked for you to kind of help mitigate the sort of potential conflicts of importance?
Well, it's a question of uncovering flexibility. At first, you probably don't know where it is. So just like on any project, when you talk about time or cost or quality, they were going to say, well, they're all important. And then I have to say, well, you're going to have to break tie somewhere. And actually between all three. So you don't get two, you get one. There's one thing that is less flexible than everything else. And so by the same token, if you're talking about two people with opposing ideas, you know, that are, you know, contradicting each other, you have to continue to ask questions about both of them, all things being equal. And if you can, and if you can do that, then with everybody in the room, or at least on the call, you can begin to tease out where somebody's willing to give a little bit more. It could be organizational. It could be political. There's really no rhyme or reason as to why those things may exist, but somewhere in there you're going to find something that helps you break that tie. Because the worst thing to do is to not know and then go stand in the middle and be the peacemaker and try to be a hero, because it's like a family fight. There's no winning when you get in the middle of that.
So, and there's a lot of water under that bridge. Like, yeah. You don't know what that history is, you know, especially if it's caught up in these two personalities. Yeah.
I was meeting with a large organization with the executives of the company that I used to work for. And we had a brand new, delivery, vice president of delivery who was there. And two of the people sitting at our end of the table at dinner in this very nice restaurant were starting to go at it. And you could tell right away that, you know, this is something that they picked at for years. And you knew both of them had been with the organization for a long time. And so you know that this conversation is you know, just festering all the time. And so they were starting to get a little shrill, and my boss was going to try to be the peacemaker, and I kicked him under the table, and then I texted him and said, don't be a hero, man, you're not going to win in this one.
that's just good.
This is a family fight.
Don't be a hero. My last question usually is, what piece of advice would you have for folks as they try and apply this lens to their own work? And I think you've hit it. Like, don't be a hero. But
well, that would not be my advice. But
what would be your advice to, if someone is, you know, as they're sort of, I've been framing this as, you know, there are a lot of folks who didn't have the experience that, say, you and I had in doing learning information architecture in the School of Hard Knocks. And it is not a topic that I see covered with any rigor these days. So what advice would you have for someone who's maybe in the early part of their design career and encountering IA problems?
It's something I learned when I still thought that I wanted to be purely a designer. And this was pre-computer. And hopefully a lot of designers will understand this, because hopefully they've all had to do the same exercise at some point. So the exercise involved the professor putting an apple in the middle of the table on the first day and telling everybody to draw the apple.
Some people were using, I can't remember what they're called. They're basically grown up crayons. Other people were using a range of pencils. And so everybody commenced to draw. And then when we were done, they all got hung up on the wall. And you could see right away that there was this serious demarcation between pictures of an apple and pictures of the apple. So there were people who drew something red with a stem and a certain kind of shape. That wasn't the apple that was in front of them. That was the apple that they carry around in their brain. It's an icon, basically. Whereas the other people were looking at the apple and they were seeing that it wasn't just red. It was in some places white, in some places kind of speckled, and other places deep, 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 almost black reds. And it was asymmetrical and there were little nicks and imperfections in it. In other words, they took the information from what was in front of them. They didn't walk in with the idea they already have in their brain. So that at face value is the first thing that I would put, which is to take the information from what's in front of you and be observant. Assume you don't know anything when you come into these. And if it turns out that you do have an alignment and an understanding, then that's a bonus. So the way that translates to more senior folks is when I realized that, having done this for a while, that I was going into some conversations and some meetings with an icon in my mind of the people I was going to be dealing with. The marketing person, the finance person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They were essentially persona. They weren't the people. Now, a persona is a good place to start. That icon, that idea of an apple is a good place to start, just so that you know you're dealing with an apple and you know, not a can of Coke. So, but that's a sketch. Then you take the information and you add that to what's going on, so you come out with something much more true. You have to do that with people too. And I've actually spoken about the value of making generalizations prior to going into a meeting with people that you haven't met, and essentially how to inform that, you know, either start with a generalization or inform to get a little bit more information. LinkedIn will tell you some interesting things.
Yeah.
You know, you may be dealing with, you know, a head of marketing, but you may see that in college, they got their degree in journalism and photography.
Right.
And so that tells you a little bit more, something a little more specific about them, about things that may be interested to them, that may be interesting to them. So to boil it down, it's basically whatever preconceptions you have about something, keep them in your hip pocket. And the more things, because you already know what they look like. And then put your attention to what's ever in front of you so that you can find out what the real story is. And when you're done, you may find that the person is a walking stereotype. But more than likely, there's going to be a little bit more information there. You know, that the head of IT may show you that they have an incredible eye for things that are of aesthetic value,
right,
or have a qualitative value, and that is important enough, depending on the circumstances, to drive towards. I call them warrior poets. So yeah, you're going to uncover folks like that from time to time. So by sticking with your generalization, you're potentially censoring yourself out of some really good information and the things that are going to help you connect and create trust and understand how a person perceives things, so you know how to go forward.
Adam, that was a fabulous bit of wisdom, and I am grateful that I could be here to listen to it. So thank you for that, and thank you for joining me on this little journey.
Happy to do it.